It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host, Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. We're doing that today with Zoom talking about ways to communicate science through the arts. Our guests with us today are Krista Hoffman-Longton, science communicator. Hi, Krista.
Hi, Mark. Good to be here, I should say.
Yeah. And Jim Ansaldo, did I get that right?
Yep, that's right.
Who's an actor and really special person who I just got to meet. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we're talking about the ways in which theater improvisation can be used to communicate science more effectively with the public. So what is improv anyway?
Jim, I'm going to let you take that one.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a simple definition of improv is that it's theater that's made up on the spot. So just like any play or musical that you might go to see with a plot, setting, and characters, but all of that is created during the moment of performance, often using one or more suggestions from the audience.
Wow. And so it's kind of like there's certain ways that you don't want to box somebody in. Do I understand that right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are familiar with the phrase of yes and as kind of the core rule, quote unquote, of improv. And what that really is about is the kind of technology for co-creating stories relies on us accepting each other's idea. So that's the yes part, and then adding to each other's ideas. And that's the and part.
That's really interesting. So Krista, I assume that in a lot of your work, that keeps us from getting into the kind of patterns that we get into where somebody controls the conversation. And this way, don't you have to be more of a listener?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I like about improv is, for me, the way that I often use it when I'm training scientists to communicate more effectively, or really any academics, that might be a researcher, it might be an artist, you know, anybody that has a sort of area of expertise that might not be familiar to the general public. The way that we sort of approach that conversation is using improv as a lens or a framework. And I think that that's really helpful because it goes back to something Jim said a minute ago, which is that that should really be a conversation, right? Focused on, you know, saying yes, accepting one another's ideas and perspectives, and then adding your own perspectives or ideas to that conversation. So I think that by definition, improv pushes us to see communication, not just as a one-way message transmission, but instead communication as working on something together, building a co-creation of meaning is often a phrase that we'll use. And really what it is it's about being a partner to whomever you're listening to and talking with.
Wow, that sounds really great, Jill. Anyway, we'll go on. Jill's having a little bit of technical trouble, so we'll just keep going. The thing that is interesting to me is how does all this connect to science and working with, you know, doctors and the School of Medicine? That seems to me to be really a kind of cutting edge thing. I've never heard of a doctor in medical school learning to communicate.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about kind of some of the history of medical improv and of using improv related to science communication. And Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about improv as sort of a therapeutic strategy, because I think it's helpful to think of improv in both ways. So if we see improv as a lens, right, as a tool to help us communicate more effectively and to help us connect and feel empathetic, then improv really has a lot of flexibility. So there's actually a whole professional organization that Jim and I have both been involved with, the Applied Improvisation Network, where improvisers use the tools and techniques of improv to do other things in the world. So that might be to solve problems within organizations or to maybe address the needs of a community. And we know that the sort of history of improv in the United States actually dates back to Viola Spolin, who is widely considered sort of the foremother of improv in the US. She actually worked with Jane Addams Hull House in Chicago. So she was really working on using theater techniques to bring together people who were very different from one another, right? Immigrant communities, folks who really just came from very broad backgrounds. And so as you apply the concepts of improv like yes and, one of my other favorite sort of tenets of improv is the idea of making your scene partner look good. The idea that we are partners together and it's my job to make Mark look good, it's Mark's job to make me look good, and that in doing that we support one another. So when you think about how you translate that into science or medicine, you can really see how physicians and scientists can benefit from partnering with their audiences, whether they are patients or they might be just audience members listening to a scientific talk, for example. Because if I'm an audience member and let's say I make an assumption that might be incorrect, you could certainly, as a scientist or as a physician, be like, nope, you're wrong, right? But the problem with that approach is that it's not a partnership then, right? It just shuts that person down. That person feels small and disconnected. But if instead that scientist says, that's not necessarily the right answer, but tell me how you got there, right? Tell me more about your thought process. Then you're creating that partnership and helping that person to see that they have value in the conversation and that they can be a part of the creative process. So I use these techniques a lot when I'm working with physicians and scientists. Jim works with me on that, but Jim also has really creative techniques that he uses to engage all different kinds of populations. So Jim, do you want to talk about some of your work?
Sure, yeah. I've been really lucky to be able to work with a variety of different professionals that really are engaging in research translation, I would say. So if you take someone like a teacher, a lot of their job is really translating educational research into practice to work with a wide variety of students. We also, at the camp that I run, it's an improv camp, we work with a lot of speech-language pathologists. And so these are folks that are doing speech therapy in schools and teaching social skills. Because in that field, the understanding of communication disorders has kind of evolved, where it used to be thought of as, for example, an individual with autism that they lacked the skills to communicate. Now, speech therapists are sort of viewing a communication disorder as something that happens between people. So it's sort of an ecological or environmental kind of phenomenon. And the suggestion is really that increasingly speech pathologists work with both the individual with autism and their communicative partners, they're called. So those might be teachers, family members, friends, employers. And so improv becomes very useful in helping those professionals learn to connect with diverse people, to make professional decisions kind of on the fly as they see how people respond to their therapeutic interventions instead of a more like recipe approach. So they really love it. And the bonus is that they have a lot of fun learning to do it as well. So it's really, for me, some of the only professional development work I've done where after a workshop, people ask, when are you going to come back and do more?
Wow. So to me, both Krista and Jim, that's what you just said redefines how we may look at communication. Because we've tended to look at it from a cognitive science viewpoint or brain viewpoint, that it's somewhere, and certainly there's some neurology and stuff involved. But this takes it to a whole new level when you think that communication between people is also a social construct. which I know doesn't surprise us, except we haven't really.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, particularly with our increased focus on culture and how culture influences communication and mutual understanding, it's really important to have some ways to work against kind of the deficit perspective that sees only one actor in any given conversation as sort of the root of the problem, quote unquote.
Wow.
Speaking of communication.
Here we go.
I'm back again.
Welcome, Jill.
This is the wonderful world of Zoom, ladies and gentlemen, who are listening on the radio. And the even better yet, I'm actually at a broadcasting place at WFYI trying to use the internet here, and it's not allowing me to. So this is actually perfect. Since we are talking about communication and trying to make it easier for people to understand things, and forgive me if this question has already been asked, but as you were explaining things, both Krista and Jim, when you do bring in scientists and specialists, how do you loosen them up to be able to be in front of people to make what they're saying not as... as academic, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about that a little bit, and then Jim, if you want to add on. I think the thing that I try to do first and foremost is start, as Jim said earlier, not from this place of deficit, like starting not from this place of, you know, either the audience is at deficit, right? The audience, you know, can't possibly understand, or even to say that the scientist doesn't have the skills, right? I mean, I often joke with my colleagues that if communication can't be taught, then I'm out of a job. So I certainly hope that we can teach it and teach it well. But I start with the idea a lot of times that we translate our ideas in so many different contexts. Right? So it's pretty on the regular that we have to talk to our family members from different fields, from different backgrounds about what we do. Or if you're a physician, you need to work with a child instead of an adult. So there are lots of places where you're translating potentially complex information for the audience at hand. And, you know, certainly there are some nice educational theories that give us ideas about how to do this. So one of my favorite theories that I use is Dreyfus's model of skill acquisition. And the shorthand for that model is the idea that when you become an expert in something, you forget what it's like to be a novice. So you sometimes forget the language that you need to be able to explain a complicated concept to someone or some, you know, to an audience that might be unfamiliar. And the example that I often use in my workshops is think about having to teach someone how to drive, right? If you know how to drive and you have driven for 20 or 30 years of your life, it's really hard to come up with the discrete concepts and skills that you need. And that's why teaching someone to drive, for example, is so frustrating, right? You do it kind of through muscle memory now, if you will. And that same concept kind of plays out when we're thinking about how to work with scientists and other experts of all types in communicating complicated concepts. Everyone is an expert in something. Even your kids could probably teach you how to play a video game that's familiar or how to, maybe draw something that is really near and dear to their hearts. So I think that part of my role is reminding my colleagues that when we talk about complicated information, that we do a lot of translation already. And these techniques that we use from improv are really designed to help them to develop adaptability and comfort so that they can, when the moment lends itself, be able to adjust and adapt their message for that audience that they have at hand. And Jim, I don't know if you want to add anything to that from your work.
Yeah, I agree with everything that was just said.
Yes, and.
I guess I also... And, you know, ironically, like the technology trouble we're having is kind of a good example of how in our work, we're helping scientists to learn how to humanize themselves to other people. That, you know, okay, so Jill's having some trouble with the internet. Like, who listening to this story hasn't had that happen to them? So Jill's a person like any other person, even along with all her expertise and experience. And I think, you know, that's kind of what the arts do, is really help us to express the different dimensions of our humanity. These techniques help scientists to both play the role of expert and play the role of regular person. And we also kind of give them some permission to share their passion, because while their work is very objective and structured and disciplined, at the heart of it, they're very passionate to learn about something new, to discover the unknown, to share their excitement about a discovery, whatever that is. And that can be kind of the key to really balance this great evidence that they've collected through the scientific method with this wonderful human passion that even if the listener doesn't have that same passion, you know, they're passionate about something, and they can feel that when somebody presents in an exciting way.
I know I used to experience that a lot as a reporter. I did a lot of medical reporting early on in my career, and you would be standing there before you rolled the camera with the medical person, and they would just be talking to you like you were any other normal person, whatever. You'd turn that camera on and they would go into doctor mode, and then you'd have to stop and turn off the camera and say to them, please speak English to me, speak people to me. And it was almost as if they didn't realize that that's what people wanted. And I think what you two are doing, it's allowing them to do that. And I'm sure that through some of the sessions that you have these medical experts and stuff that have learned that they love doing it that way. And why haven't I been presenting my science this way all along?
Absolutely. You know, and when you think about someone who becomes a doctor, they've spent a long time in school, and they've worked really hard, and they've been trained in a very specific style of communication that they need to use within their field. And so it's no wonder that it would take some different kind of training and learning to be able to connect with different kinds of audiences that have different needs.
Right. And, you know, for me, I've had this conversation with many people that are scientists and doctors, but they'll go to a conference within their own specialty, right? And somebody will present, and they will not raise their hand and say they're confused or they don't know what they're talking about. And yet often, if you ask them, they are confused and don't know what the speaker's talking about, even within it. So this goes back to basic, do you read your audience? So here we go again with arts and theater arts, right? Are you getting a sense that your audience is with you? Do they get it? Or do you just babble on?
Yeah, how do you guys read your audiences? What cues do you look for?
So one of the things that I think is powerful about what you just said, Mark, in terms of being able to read your audience, is that when you're, you know, no matter how much of an expert you've become in your field, the fear of public speaking is still there, right? That's so real that even as you develop as an expert, especially if your audience also carries a level of expertise, right? Because there's always that question, do I know what I'm talking about? Do these people believe that I know what I'm talking about? And I think about how you become an expert in a field. And you know, if you look at sort of the field of expertise studies, we know that it's an incredible amount of practice, right? That it's that those very small behaviors over and over and over again that help you to develop a level of expertise. And just because you've developed a level of expertise in your field doesn't necessarily mean you'd get up in front of an audience of 300 or 400 people and just be at the ready to talk about that at any moment. And I think that for Jim and I, as we've worked with our colleagues in how to communicate their passion and how to connect with one another about their work, I think that going back to that place of passion becomes a really useful tool in helping folks to read their audience, right? So that doesn't mean that you don't communicate the, as Jim said, really objective findings of your research, but starting with, here's a question that puzzled me, or here's a challenge I ran into as I did this research or approached this problem. I think that all of us have those experiences, regardless of our level of expertise, whether that's about feeling a challenge that we couldn't, you know, overcome, or an issue that we didn't know the answer to. And so starting from those places of commonality, that place of common ground, and then kind of going into the more in-depth information, we've found has been a really useful tool to help our scientist colleagues, research colleagues, and I would argue even some of our friends who are artists, to be able to read that, to read the audience, is starting from that place of passion. And Jim, I'm not sure if you want to add on to that.
I guess bring up, there's kind of an improv phrase known as follow the follower. And what that kind of brings up is that once somebody makes kind of the initial offer in an improv scene to tell us a little bit about who we are or where we are or what we're doing, it really becomes a cyclical process of responding to the other person's response. And so I think that practice in a low stakes setting of an improv game or that sort of thing really does help you build that reflex to be able to respond to the responses of your audiences. And again, these are experts, so they know their field. They really don't need to memorize a script in order to be able to give people information about their work, but really kind of practice that technique of responding to the responses.
Well, we hope our listeners are responding in a good way, enjoying this conversation with Jim Ansaldo, actor, and Krista Hoffman Longton. As I'm Zooming now via phone, thank you, Mark, and we're gonna take a short little break and then hopefully be back with more of our conversation. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time.
To an era that started a rebellion.
We're the rebel, yeah. She cried more, more, more.
We're even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shaped rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're talking about ways to communicate science through theater with Krista Hoffman Longton and Jim Ansaldo. And when we were, just before we were going away for our break, there were some interesting things that were coming forward. And I want to return to one that you mentioned earlier, Jim. And that was this idea of the social aspect or the community aspect of communication. And you were talking about children who may have autism and that the construct is there. But I think it's interesting that we sometimes also, don't you think, Krista, also, don't we also structure things? Every conference I go to, every single conference, really, and they know better, including people that are educators, they structure it with a keynote speaker, a panel, and then if they get around to it after everybody's bored stiff, the audience gets to ask questions. Why do we do that?
You know, I think part of it is economics in terms of the venues that are available and, you know, being able to you know, make enough back to pay for holding the conference and that kind of thing. And then I think part of it is just tradition. And I can say I'm guilty of being someone who's gone into a conference that is set up to be a lecture and physically picking up the chairs and moving them to the side of the room so that I can run a workshop. Because I'm the first person that doesn't want to hear me speak for 2 hours.
But isn't it, a lot of it, it's just, that's the way it's always been done. So that's the way we're going to do it. How do we break down those walls?
I think that there are small things that we can do to break those down. Because I think the other thing that we talked about kind of leading up to this segment is about that notion of reading your audience. And I think that sometimes we as audience members are trained to not be great audience members, right? We're trained with the idea that we're going to come and probably answer some emails on our phone while we're listening with one ear to that keynote speaker. I would never do that for you, Jim. But I think that I think that part of what that's about is the idea of this continuous partial attention that we're so used to operating under, right? The idea that we've always got our phones open or we've always got one other thing. And one of the things I love about these improv techniques is that they really are designed to help you to be present with one another and to be present with your audience. Because at the end of the day, your audience members are giving you time, one of the most precious things that they have. And something that we all don't have enough of. And so knowing that that's the case, really being able to, I think, tune in and listen very deeply to what does your audience need at that moment? And how can I adapt my presentation in real time to meet the needs of my audience members? Sort of seeing myself as a speaker in service to my audience, as opposed to I'm just here to deliver information, right? I often say if the audience member just wanted the information, they could read it. That would be the most efficient way to do it. But the audience comes to see and hear that person, right? To really feel what they're feeling. And I think that comes from tuning in really deeply. And so many of the techniques that Jim and I use to connect with our scientists and our researchers and other colleagues that use improv techniques is to focus on how do I really give you that full attention? And as a speaker, turn my attention outward to my audience to be able to connect fully.
Wow. Because I think a lot of speakers, they'll say, well, I have my PowerPoint. Or I have, you know, this visual presentation. Isn't that enough?
Yeah, and the worst thing when they actually hand out the PowerPoint slides on paper, I might as well not go because I could have done it. Plus, there's too much text. You know, I go back to somebody. There was a person. Her first name is fleeting me right now, but Duarte. And she wrote a book on...
Nancy is her first name, and she's amazing for the listeners out there.
Technology. And she did a lot of coaching of Steve Jobs, who I think was one of the very best public speakers that we've had. And part of that was he used like 10 slides to go for an hour. And there was very little text on it. And most of it was you had to pay attention to him. And he was so entertaining that you couldn't help but pay attention to him because you didn't know what next he was going to say. I love that.
Yeah, and one of the other things that we're trying to help scientists to do is get clear about what their goal is for any given opportunity for communication, whether it's an interview or a conference presentation or whatever. So are you wanting to get an audience really fired up about a particular issue? Are you wanting them to go and download your paper and read it because they're so curious about it? Are you wanting to learn about them and the ways that they might think about or respond to your information? All different goals that then can suggest different kinds of techniques. You know, and there are people that are brilliant lecturers that really can hold the attention of a large room for a long time. I am not one of them, but they do exist. So I'm not suggesting that that's always a poor choice, but different methods for different goals.
And I'm guessing that's a really important part of your connection with that client, is to set them down. Do you have like a list of questions to kind of dig deeper into them to get them focused on that, to see what is it that I really want to deliver in this presentation?
Jim, do you want to talk about half-life?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's an improv game that we'll play with people called Half-Life. And depending on how much time you have, we start with an allotted amount of time, anywhere from 1 to 2 minutes, and give someone an opportunity to talk with a partner about their work. And then in each successive round, we ask people to reflect a little bit about what they said, what the key points were, what the other person seemed to be most interested in, given their body language. And then we give them half the time in the first round to give the information again, with the guidance of, you know, don't speak more quickly, speak more strategically. And to the point where they'll have maybe 15 seconds. It's, you know, the literal elevator conversation where you get in the elevator with a congressperson and you have 15 seconds to get them interested in your work. And that can really help them to think about what they feel is most relevant in their work, again, what they're passionate about, and then how that connects to their goal for interacting with that audience.
One of the things I'll add to that is that what comes after the successive rounds of practice is an interview with the listener. So we'll ask the speaker, okay, interview your listener and ask them a series of questions, kind of to Jill's point. And I love these questions because they are very action oriented for the speaker. So they're questions like asking your audience member, your listener, what do you remember most about what I told you? What sticks out as the most important image in your mind? What still don't you understand? And so in just 3 or 4 minutes, the colleagues that we work with can have really concrete feedback on, here's kind of what the main message is. And if the message that they sent was not the message that that listener received, we know they've got some more work to do. Also asking that very concrete question of what still don't you understand, I think is a really useful strategy for anyone who's giving a talk, you know, to be able to get actionable feedback on what they're doing and how they can adapt their message to meet their audience's needs.
I can only imagine the looks on their faces as well. Once they've been through something like that, they have to be discovering new things about themselves that they didn't even know when it came to interacting with their listeners.
Absolutely. And a lot of times remembering specific stories from their work, which is another technique that we haven't really touched on, but you know, we know in a lot of different contexts how powerful stories are. And so helping people to rediscover those stories. And again, you know, depending on your goal for your audience. So conveying a story about what got you hooked on this work, conveying a story about working with some people in the field or one of your research subjects or that sort of thing. Those are some other pieces that we work on. And again, improv can really help with that because there are some pretty handy tools to allow people to create stories on the fly.
But do you think that when we are doing, preparing for a presentation, let's say we have an hour long one, that it might be useful to build in there that there's time for unexpected? Don't you think that's part of our problem? We prepare a PowerPoint, we rehearse it, and we go through that, or we're ready to meet, you know, we're a doctor and we have 20-minute appointment and we've and we've got it all, you know, slated, and we're just going to run through it. But I don't think we build the time in there to do what you're talking about.
I think that that's absolutely true. When I think about the ways that we use improv techniques, we often talk about them as drills to an athlete or scales to a musician, right? It's not like Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen just went out and played the most beautiful basketball in the world, right? The way that they got great at doing that was by focusing on fundamentals, on small chunks of the game. They shot a million free throws and layups. And so when I think about how that translates for someone who's going up to give a talk, instead of just sort of thinking of your talk as this long arc, instead think of it in tiny chunks. Because if you think of it in tiny chunks, then it does, to your point, Mark, offer an opportunity to pause, to really capitalize on the excitement and interest of your audience, and maybe tell one of those cool stories that could, you know, invite potential collaboration, that could, you know, again, spark that interest for someone in the audience who maybe is thinking about going into your field. So I think you're right, Mark, that packing our, let's say, hour-long talk full of content really doesn't get us at the goal. If the goal is about connecting with the audience and helping the audience to see themselves in the content.
Yeah, it's about peeling back the layers of a person. And what that was an excellent point there, Chris, said that when an expert goes in to present their information, if they're so wrapped up in that information that they forget who they're in front of and why they're there, it's going to be boring for everyone, including themselves, and they're not going to get their point across. It's when they do take that pause that they allowed the human side of them to come out, that people better connect with them. And in this day and age too, I mean, obviously with technology that works and sometimes doesn't, it is even more of an opportunity to do that. And I think you also have several generations now that are really used to people just laying it on the line, pouring it all out to them. As opposed to maybe generations before where, you know, you kept your work and your professionalism pretty much to yourself. And when you gave a presentation, it was all about your work. It wasn't anything about that you had personally experienced with this work, because that might make you look as if you're not as credible as you are.
Yeah, you know, it makes me wonder when you guys are talking too, that it's a concept of making space for a conversation. And I think we don't do that sometimes in our interpersonal. It's a one, we expect I'm going to talk and then you talk. And we don't teach, I know I've watched in elementary, we don't teach kids to do that very often, of how do I have a conversation with somebody rather than it's your turn to talk and now it's your turn to talk, which is okay from a control viewpoint to some degree, but it doesn't really get that part of a conversation is I need to listen to you, and then I need to parrot back a little bit of what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, I come back to improv again, because a lot of what we work on is sharing focus. There will be a moment for me to bring my idea to the stage, and that idea will kind of have its little arc, or what we'll call the beats of a scene. And then when that beat is through, I need my partner to step in and add something to it to heighten or add more detail to what I've brought to the stage. And so that back and forth happens. And I agree, it's that same kind of thing to do the drill practice that Krista was talking about, to the point where we can be comfortable to know we'll be able to respond, and we can give that other person their moment to have their beat.
And that back and forth is what's so beautiful, right? I mean, I'll say something a little bit controversial. I mean, I don't know how controversial, but like, you know, one of my favorite cartoons is from The Oatmeal. And it's that cartoon that starts, it's actually at the top of my Twitter feed. It has some salty language in it, but generally, conceptually, I think it's really good. because the cartoon starts out with, you're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you. Mm-hmm. And it asks us to sort of question where our beliefs come from. And at the end of the day, I think that I enter every conversation with the idea that I might potentially be changed by that conversation. That's what I want from conversations. I want to come to a conversation with the idea that I might leave and be a different person or think differently in some way because of that person that I've spoken to. And I think that that offer, that true openness of what would it look like to be changed by a conversation is what makes conversation so powerful and interesting. And so when we talk with our scientist colleagues or our, you know, physicians that we work with or other researchers, I always say, how could an audience member sort of change your focus here? And what could you get from that? What could you learn from that as a researcher? And I think that's really powerful. And to Jim's point, is about sharing that spotlight, is about sharing that beat and sharing that moment together.
And that trust that you then create as well.
You know,
absolutely.
It's interesting. I wonder if in evangelical and African-American churches, that because there is a feedback mechanism where people are expressing themselves verbally and even physically, if that doesn't make sometimes for a better speaker, doesn't make everybody that way, but I think there must be something in there that where the audience is able to give a feedback to the person in real time. I know, Jim, as an actor, you live for that when you're on stage, because we all hate a dead audience. When I was doing theater, it was terrible. You know, you get the, unfortunately, I don't want to stereotype, but you get the late second matinee Sunday afternoon, and there it was a snooze fest, and it was hard on the actors to keep energy and do that. But you do drive energy from your audience.
Oh, absolutely. And in particular, you know, being someone who performs in improv comedy, I would say probably 3 times out of 4, I have no idea if the thing I'm about to say is funny or not. It's really my audience, and it'll be like, oh, they like that. I'm going to do more of that. And you know, then you milk that thing until it's
right.
Over.
And often audience specific. So what worked one night isn't working the other night.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of my great joys in improv, in particular with the group Comedy Sports that I perform with, is, you know, we challenge ourselves to do improv shows for everyone. So all the way, you know, from little kids to older folks people from all different cultural groups. And it's a wonderful challenge to be able to make that many different kinds of people laugh. Yeah.
Well, we are challenging our audience today, our listeners, helping them to learn better ways to communicate science through theater with some great help from Jim Anseldo. You just heard him speaking, and Kristen Hoffman-Longton. We're going to take a short break, but before we do, we want to remind you that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission, which is creating a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and the community can come together for unique activities and conversations just like this one. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back with it.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of the Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise, and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Well, welcome back. We are speaking once again via Zoom with Krista Hoffman-Longton and Jim Ansaldo. We're talking about ways to communicate science through theater. And you guys have piqued our interest all the way through this conversation. What's it like being part of Comedy Sports Improv Troupe?
It's incredible, honestly, because there's not only 40 to 50 people involved in Comedy Sports Indianapolis that range in age, race, gender, ability, sexual orientation. So, you know, we're learning to work together and create comedy from the truths of our lives as individuals. Then you have our audience. But then on top of that, there are 30 different cities in the US and one in Manchester, UK. So I have had the great pleasure of traveling to other states, over a dozen other states, and playing with other improvisers there and for their audiences. So it's really exciting to be able to improvise in all those different cultural contexts.
That's amazing. I want to return to one thing. Well, it's kind of two things that you guys were talking about. One was, I love the idea of beats. It reminds me of music. But then I, in my mind, I quickly went to dance. And I think of a conversation as a dance with beats. Am I getting it?
Yeah, I would say so. I think I heard the story that I think the term beats comes from Stanislavski. And I don't know if this is true, that he really said bits, but because of his accent, people heard beats.
Oh, that's funny.
but to me, as somebody who loves music, that's very much how I think about it.
Right, we're going to keep that story, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think in the larger piece, that there are kind of movements within a piece of music, so that even through the arc of an entire show, you kind of have these sections that have a certain feel to them, and you kind of get to feel when it's time to shift, when the audience is ready, let's say, for the plot to sort of accelerate or for the conclusion to be reached or that sort of thing.
Ah, Jim, that's so fun. That was just like, I want to add on to that. I was thinking about, like, I'm a huge jazz fan. Mark knows that I'm a huge jazz fan. And that's one of the things I think that's so powerful about thinking about improv and thinking about, we think about communicating scientific concepts or even think about art more broadly, visual art and so on, that art is not structureless, right? That there is a structure that exists, whether you talk about, you know, the improv comedy or talk about jazz, for example, that it, you know, I was reading one of my favorite books that is about creativity and improv, and a concept that I use a lot when I'm working with my colleagues in the sciences and medical field is a book by Keith Sawyer called Group Genius. And Keith is an educator by training, but he went to different organizations all over the US that were known to be creative. So he went to 3M and to Google and even to Savannah College of Art and Design. And then he kind of gathered the principles that they used to help people be creative and put them into this book to build creative teams. One of the things that he found, for example, is that in order to be most creative, you need a little bit of constraint, right? That the most creative moments often come not from just a blank slate, but that you have some constraints. And I think in a lot of ways, as you were, you know, talking, Jim, about the concept of beats, or even the concept of, you know, the story arc or the structure of a scientific talk, that that little bit of structure kind of pushes you to be creative if you take the opportunity. And so I think that's one of the things I love about using improv and storytelling techniques to work with scientists, is to remind them that the structure can be there as sort of a safety net if you need it, but it also gives you a chance to push into something more creative.
You know, and I think that those metaphors that you're talking about using from the arts, particularly from music, like crescendo here, a pause, those kinds of things, particularly I think scientists and doctors are pretty well known to actually be very involved in music. And you may tap into something when you're talking to them with that, that they can understand.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's that wonderful crossover between art and science that's happening.
Yeah, and I'll often talk about, you know, professionals needing to orchestrate a set of skills. And, you know, we could talk about that even with the Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen kind of metaphor, that there isn't a recipe, a sequence, that professionals have this set of skills and they need to be able to orchestrate those skills to match the situation, the audience, the goal, the responses and all of that. And I think whether it's teachers that I work with or scientists or medical professionals, there's a sense of freedom that comes along with feeling some more balance between that structure and that decision-making and the kind of orchestration process between those.
Have you found that certain groups are easier to adapt to this and more willing to incorporate these methods into their presentations than others?
So Jim looks like he's thinking, and while he's thinking, I have an initial idea. So I'm gonna just talk for a second. So in my experience, some of our earlier scientific learners struggle with these concepts. And I think it is something about feeling comfortable with the science before you kind of get that feeling of, you know, that comfort in your skin to be able to improvise, to be able to adapt to the situation. You've got to feel confident in that sense of expertise that you have. And so sometimes that takes a little bit of time. So I use a different set of techniques when I work with our more kind of junior scientists. And when I say junior, I mean high school students, undergraduates. Then as I work with folks that are more expert in the field, I use different techniques to kind of bring them in. So that's been my experience. But Jim, I'd love to hear sort of your thoughts about that.
For me, what I've noticed that can be difficult is when there's a culture, no matter what group I'm working with, if the culture doesn't allow for risk-taking and grappling with mistakes. So, you know, if we take medical professionals, for example, certainly in their work, mistakes can be very serious. But if they treat every situation, every context, including the learning context, as that high stakes, it can be very difficult to engage in this kind of work. And that can be hard, to this idea that it's okay to make a mistake when I'm learning, and then there's this other situation where the mistakes are much higher stakes. That the group culture can be difficult sometimes.
That's a great point, Jim, I agree.
You know, I wonder how much, we think about this a lot in visual arts, but in all of it, you're talking about theater arts and music and all the other, but I wonder how much of it is when you think back to little kids and they don't have, I wonder how much is taught to us of embarrassment, or I might do something wrong, or I might feel that and not try. And it sounds like both of you are trying to get people to come out of that.
And I think that's absolutely true, Mark, that's really the overlap between my and Jim's example. What an astute observation that you just made, right? That that in a lot of ways, when I talk about some of my junior scientist colleagues, maybe not yet sort of developing that sense of expertise, there's a fear of that risk. There's a fear of being wrong. And, you know, to Jim's point that thinking about how do I sort of modulate those two spaces where in some contexts it's okay to take risks and it's okay to be wrong. And in other contexts, I really got to attend to that. That's really, really astute. Yeah, I think you're right.
Thank you.
We've only got a couple of minutes here left, but we need to touch on the fact that, you know, we've been talking about that it's this, the trust and connecting with your audience. Now many of your clients are probably having to do these things virtually. And where is the audience reaction with that?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we've been doing a lot of work with online improv really since March. And it's been fascinating to me how much we can still connect, even though we're in these weird little Zoom rectangles in two places at once. But, you know, Mark and Jill, I feel like I know you. I feel like I have some connection with you, that if we, you know, someday in the future, if we met up, you know, at a bookstore or something like that, we could have a nice little chat. So there are some differences, I think, in the virtual realm in terms of how we do it. But for me, at least, if I still place connection first, then that's really the key. And we can do that even across electronic distances.
I think that's really a great point, Jim. And I was thinking about my father is by himself. My mother died a year ago, and he's living fine in his house, but his big thing is loneliness, which is almost an illness. But he figured out that by contacting other lonely people, it helped both. And it's kind of what you're saying, right? I mean, all of us during this, if we don't have a connection, so people are longing for some sort of, at least some sort of social connection and being able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think in some ways it's interesting that this technology is humanizing us a little more in some ways. Like the listeners can't see this obviously, but you know, I'm broadcasting from my bedroom. And so for the people who've just met me, like I'm a real person. I've got a room, I've got, you know, a photo from my wedding on the wall and that sort of thing. And so there are some nice pieces about this distance technology that can humanize us more to each other.
Wow.
And I think I've definitely been humanized this evening here with recording our conversation. We want to thank both of you guys for putting up with my struggle with the Zoom technology here. Krista Hoffman Longton and Jim Insaldo, thank you both for being guests with us here on our Da Vinci Pursuit show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. And you'll find pictures of their projects and those of other guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
Until next time, wherever that is, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to stay
curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.